Hey everyone, welcome into another edition of the Woj Pod. Here with the great Zach Lowe, who had a very productive week at ESPN. They're all productive. Zach, great Brandon Ingram profile. Your 10 things I think I like today. And Mike Schmitz on the low post talking NBA rookies this week. How are you, Zach?
I'm good. The sun is out. I feel a little better about life, and I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Ready for the weekend.
I feel a little better about life too this week, but we'll move on from that. Let me ask you this, Zach. In a normal season, you know, 15, 16 games in, depending on which team you are in the league right now, some are much fewer than that. How many games would you have been to already between living in the New York metropolitan area, between the Knicks, the Nets, maybe a road trip somewhere early on? That Brandon Ingram piece you did, you might have flown in and done that.
Yeah.
Have you been to any games?
I haven't been to one, partly because I don't see the utility, and partly because it requires now advance notice and levels of organization that I don't always have going on in my life. I would like to go, frankly, just to get out of the house and see basketball in person, but I haven't yet. In a normal year, probably by now I would have gone to LA at least once, and I would have gone there during a Lakers-Clippers home-heavy part of the schedule, so I would go and knock out three or four games. Seen a couple of games here already. I'd probably be up to six or seven by now, and of course I have not been to a game since March of 2020 in Boston, when probably none of us should have been going to games, but c'est la vie.
Yeah. Yeah. Outside the bubble, obviously we went to a lot of games in the bubble every day, but pre-shutdown, there was a game in LA. I think about it a lot. Should have been at it. It was the Laker Clipper game on Sunday. We did NBA countdown courtside, and you knew you weren't supposed to be shaking hands. I don't think I was shaking hands. I remember it was the first time somebody gave me one of those elbow bumps. And yeah, that was the last time in Staples Center. You're right. And like this time of year, any time of year, you go to LA, like you said, if the Clippers and Lakers are both home and you have visiting teams coming in, and then the teams, if they have a break a day or two in their schedule, they stay an extra day or two in LA. So you can get with guys there. We stayed out at the LA Live area. Some of the teams, you know, they might stay up in Beverly Hills, but some would stay downtown based on their schedule.
And God bless the teams that stay downtown. Anonymous downtown teams, I love you. Keep staying downtown. don't flee to the beach because it takes forever to get there.
Well, even worse is the ones who, you know, the Beverly Hills, when you got to go out to Beverly Hills to chase down at the Montage, right? Teams like to stay at the Montage. Lovely hotel, but a hike from downtown. But yeah, I miss it. I miss, you know, even if you go to a Nets game here or you go to a Knicks game, you can't go down on the court and talk with assistants before the game, see the GMs, grab the coach, grab, you know, see players. You can't do any of it. And so you're right. The value is, for us, not great. And I don't know if that's going to change. I'm not sure that's going to change at all this year. Even if we have fans in the building, I don't think we'll get physically close to anybody. And never mind trying to do a podcast with somebody at their hotel. I miss that. I miss going, hey, team's coming into the city. They land at 5. He'll be ready to do the podcast with you at 6:30.
Which, by the way, it's never going to be 6:30. Whatever they say, it's never going to be. There's going to be traffic from the airport. They're going to get dinner for. It's going to be 2 hours after that. But yes, that rat race is enjoyable in some perverse way.
Well, I miss sitting there and waiting. Yeah, but yeah, that's it's different. And you know, our audience suffers for it. I think everybody suffers for it. But it's the reality of, you know, grinding through this season. We'll see. Again, I don't know that it'll be any different this year. We've got to get through this season. And one thing I wanted to bring up, Zach, to start off with was, you know, we've had 20 postponements of games this season. Memphis has had 4 straight now. Washington will be coming back here soon after being out for, they haven't played since last Monday. So almost over a week and a half, almost to a Friday, almost 2 weeks. And a shift in the league, how the league is handling this, and you saw it in the Memphis. They had, let's say, they postponed two games against the Blazers, two games against the Kings. They were going to be in Portland for two games and then down to Sac. And essentially what the league was doing was, yeah, if a player tested positive or they thought a player had been exposed, the contact tracing was, and I'll give you an example, and I won't say which team, there was a player got put in contact tracing because one of his teammates who tested positive, they drove into the game together, picked them up. They lived near each other, drove in. So the other player had to go in contact tracing. And there's actually a formula the league has. I think it's 15 minutes. I think anything over 15 minutes with somebody or around somebody, they look at tape to see on the court, on the bench, to try to measure out the time. They'll do that. And then off the court, obviously, you're at the, you know, you've got to report that in. And typically, they're going to try to err on the side of caution. But essentially, what the league is saying, we're not going to sift through this Memphis roster, see if we have eight players based on contact tracing. We're shutting them down. The word I heard was, we're going to park them. And we're not going, they are worried about player to player contact on the floor, player to player transmission. And I have to believe that's going to lead to more postponed games, because that's the minimum bar for, I mean, you're going to have guys continue to test positive. And so it's hard to believe there's going to be that every team's going to get to 72 games, Zach. And by the time we get to the playoffs, it may look like we're going to do it by winning percentage, or I don't know if there's any other way to do it. They have a window to make up games. And wait till that happens, Zach. We get into that 2 week break the players are supposed to have, and they say,
yeah, it's not going to be a break for a lot of players.
What did we call it in school? It was like your snow days. We got to make up your snow days on February.
Yeah,
vacation.
You got to make it. That's why the 2 hour delay was always better than a snow day. Just let me sleep in and count the day, bank the day. I don't have to make it up later in the year.
Yeah, the 2 hour delay was, I hadn't thought about that in a while. But yeah, and listen, this is a league now that is, they put in more stricter guidelines over the last couple of weeks. They want to see if the numbers go down. The numbers went from 16 positives to 11 positives this week. They hope it'll go down again next week. And essentially, you have players who aren't players and staff not allowed to leave their hotels, not allowed to have guests in rooms. And at home, it's pretty strict. It's pretty strict for teams in their home markets, too. We'll see how sustainable that is. I don't think it's going to be the rest of the season that.
There was a two. That was initially a 2 week like temporary measure. Yes. Are we at 2 weeks yet? I just lost track. We're got to be close.
So
right?
I think January 12th today is what, the 22nd. So 10 days in, 11 days in.
So they've already got to be talking about then. Do we extend these? Do we renew? I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, and so they were going to revisit it at two. I do think it'll go a little longer than two. I don't think it'll end at two. But I don't know that it can go much, much longer than that. What's your sense, Zach, of the level of patience and buy-in there still is around the league to grind through this? Because it all, like as teams have said from the beginning, we're only as strong as our weakest link in teams. And again, it just takes – it's literally takes one player or one staff member to shut down a team now for a period of time.
Well, and that's you know, you've seen the frustration from the Sixers and from Brad Beal this week about, you know, team's saying it's not fair for why are we being forced to play with eight guys, whereas some teams are able to have their games postponed. And in Brad's case, it was, I don't think we're ready to ramp back up. I don't think we have enough guys really ready to ramp back up like that. And that kind of frustration is going to be part of the season. And now the league appears to be, according to your reporting in the Memphis story, taking a sort of opposite tact of, rather than have these skeleton crews out, we're just going to park a team on the sidelines. And look, you mentioned the league being worried. I think you said the league is worried about player-to-player transmission on the floor. And, you know, in their health protocols, they have this definition, again, 15 cumulative minutes within close range over 24 hours. And they went out of their way to say, well, we look at the second spectrum data, the tracking data, it shows that's actually quite unusual for two players to be within whatever distance of each other for 15 minutes a game. And they have this testing regimen right? Two tests a day. Now it's going to be three in a lot of cases. They're pushing back start times of games now furiously to try and get a PCR test done pregame. And the whole point of that is, if someone's positive on game day, we're going to catch it. Or if they test they're going to test negative, and the reason they're going to test negative, even if they end up having had the virus, is because the load of the virus is so low that they're essentially 0% chance they're going to be contagious. So they have all of these built-in mechanisms to prevent or limit player-to-player transmission. If those mechanisms turn out to be not enough, or let me put it like this, if player transmission turns out to be more of a reality and more of a concern than they had initially conceived of it, despite all the measures, and you can't test players eight times a day, they're doing about the best they can, then the NBA is going to be facing a larger problem. But I do think one of the things you mentioned before, all these teams, these postponements, the teams parked, the skeleton crew teams, it gives off the impression of an outbreak. And in one case, the Wizards, I don't know what qualifies as an outbreak.
I think that qualifies as an outbreak.
But 11 positives this week, 16 last week. If it drops again, knock on wood, it's not an avalanche of positive cases. I think that is important to remember. That's not why this is happening. It's the contact tracing.
Yeah, I love every time you report one of these games is postponed and you just get all the comments on Twitter. Shut it down, cancel the season. It's funny, they didn't do that so much in football. I never heard that in football. And think of the weeks in the NFL where Denver played without a quarterback one week. I think somebody played without really any wide receivers. I went through the quarterback room or the wide receiver room. Here's the thing, Zach. Getting through this regular season is one thing. It is hard to imagine that this could be sustainable in the playoffs. And it's funny, going into the bubble, we talked a lot about what happens when a player tests positive and or somebody goes in contact tracing in the middle of a series and it throws the series. And we got into the bubble and realized, well, that's probably not going to happen, that this thing really is self-contained. And it was certainly it saved the season. It is hard to imagine, Zach, and I keep getting this back from people, that without vaccinated players or without a bubble, how do you have the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, you can have them. It's more of a, how do we have a representative playoffs? How do we get through it without, you know, one of the three or four best teams essentially having to go forward with a 25% version of itself? You know, if their best player gets the virus, that's it. It's over. And so then everyone will scream asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. And I've said all along, and you have too, no one has ever wiped the playoff bubble or last two rounds bubble or some sort of late season bubble off the whiteboard. I mean, that's never been totally dismissed. It's not something anybody wants to do. There are tons of wild cards between now and then, the most important of which, as you mentioned, is the speed of vaccination, both for the player community and just the general populace. We don't really know how that's going to unfold. Adam Silver floated this week at a conference, like maybe players can serve as sort of a public service announcement. Maybe that will allow us to quote unquote, I mean, he didn't say it, but skip the line and get vaccinated early. So we don't know how any of these things are going to unfold. But yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody wants a super compromised postseason and a champion where people look at it and say, well, was that really the champion? You know, and again, all of these things, it's important to remember, I keep saying this, all these things are collectively bargained. And the players, you know, the players are not just passive recipients of these policies from on high. Now, some of these things, like these two-week rule changes, they are done really, really fast. And I don't think every player has a chance to really contemplate them or make their voices known, because there's 450 players and these changes are being made on the fly. And so it does, in those cases, it's, if you're just a random player, it does probably feel like it's coming at you. But the general big, should we have the season? How? Should we have a playoff bubble eventually? All of those things the players are participating in. And, you know, at the root of this, a lot of it is, if you shut down the league, everybody loses their money. And that's that's why all of this stuff is collectively bargained. There's no great solution to any of this, but I do think it's important to remember that the players are active participants. I mean, ask Chris Paul how much time he's put in, and Andre Iguodala how much time he's put in, Michelle Roberts, on and on to try to make this happen.
NBA fans, listen up. You've got to try Pick 6, the newest fantasy app from DraftKings, an official partner of the NBA. Getting started is simple. Select if a player will have more or less of a stat. For example, will a player have more than one rebound, or will a player have less than 3.5 assists? Pick your favorite players and compete for huge cash prizes. Download the new DraftKings Pick 6 app now using code PARLAY and take on the competition with your best NBA player picks. Only on DraftKings Pick 6 with code PARLAY. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 18 plus in most eligible states. Age varies by jurisdiction. Eligibility restrictions apply. Pick 6 not available in all states, including but not limited to Connecticut and New York. For up-to-date lists of states, visit dkng.co/pick6states. Void where prohibited. See terms at pick6.draftkings.com/promos.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand slams, web gems with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Let's move back to the court. Let's start with Brooklyn, Zach, because that's it feels like every conversation in the league starts with them right now. To you, what's the bigger issue? Feels like a first take question. But what's the bigger issue for the Nets? Is it how the big three plays together offensively, how they coexist? Can they make that work? Or is it whether this team is going to have enough size, enough of a bench that it believes in, enough of a defensive, can they be just good enough? Can they become just good enough defensively to be able to win the championship or get to the finals? As you know, you've got to be able to, they're going to have to be much more proficient on that end of the floor. Which to you is a bigger concern for this team?
It's not even close to me, and it's defense. Offense, those three will figure it out. Will it always be super elegant? I think it actually might almost always be super elegant. But will one guy every night feel maybe somewhat unhappy? I don't know. I think the offense will take care of itself. This has a chance to be one of the greatest offensive teams of all time. The defense and the size, and look, they'll get on the buyout market. They'll get another center. They'll get another guy just to round out the rotation and bring some size. But like you said, I mean, you can't win the championship. I mean, maybe these guys will prove the exception. But if you're just awful on defense, you're going to run into a series where you've got to guard a little bit and get rebounds. And they're not a good rebounding team. They weren't a good rebounding team when they were bigger than they are now when they had Jared Allen. And that's going to be a little bit of a struggle. To me, their model is, you know, everyone wants, whenever you see this conglomeration of stars, right, the comparison is always, well, look at the Warriors. The Warriors had an amazing offense, but they were also a top three defense every year. You have to be a top three defense to win the championship. I don't think you actually, it certainly helps, but to me, their model is more the 2016 and 2017 Cavaliers, the team that won the championship and the following year, which was an even better team that ended up losing to iteration one of the Durant Warriors in the finals. That was clearly a championship caliber team in Cleveland, and it was super, super, super elite offense and good to okay defense, like 12th best. When you turn it on in the playoffs, you're suddenly equivalent to like the 10th best defense. You can win that way, and to me, that's their model more than those Warriors models. But yeah, I mean, you've got to, that means you have to guard at a decent level. And to me, that's by far the bigger challenge. The offense is going to be fine unless the ego clashing, which we don't even know if it doesn't appear to everyone appears fine. Unless that becomes such a big problem, I think the offense will take care of itself.
Yeah, I want to see what the leadership looks like, not just among the big three, but among the rest of the group. Who's going to elevate the rest of that group? I think that's important for that team. And I think the Nets have three roster spots open now. And I do think they want to bring in some more veteran, not just size, but some veterans, some good locker room guys there. And then Steve Nash's learning curve. It is. It's one thing to be a first-time head coach. It's another thing to be a first-year head coach when you're going to be in the playoffs and you're going to be in, you know, drag-out seven-game series against a Mike Budenholzer, against a Doc Rivers, against a Brad Stevens, against an Eric Spoelstra. And I think for Steve Nash, you know, that's the other that takes time, and that takes a lot of trial and error as a head coach. And no matter how great of a staff you have around you, it's still the head coach in that moment of truth that's got to be ready to make the adjustments, all the things you've got to do in a postseason. And I think that's the race. They knew that when they hired Steve. I mean, they knew that. But it's going to be a big part of this.
Just think of how fast life happens in the NBA. In the scheme of the world, like yesterday, the Nets were a frisky young culture team. Oh, look at our culture. We play hard. We build from the ground up. We dug out of this hole with a young grinding coach in Kenny Atkinson. That was like 72 hours ago in like the grand scheme of things. And now Steve Nash is their head coach. Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant, and James Harden are all on the team. Almost nobody is left from that, you know, D'Angelo Russell, look at us. We're a 40-whatever win team. We're grinding. We're rah, rah, rah. It's like Joe Harris and Jacques Vaughn and like a couple assistants that are somewhere floating around. That's it.
I remember standing with Rich Kleiman, who is Kevin Durant's business partner, and it was the Warriors were in Brooklyn in KD's last season. It was early in the season, and Golden State came in. The Nets beat them. And I remember standing out in the hallway and, you know, you were thinking about free agency. Brooklyn was, you knew that Brooklyn was at that point was going to try to be very aggressive to go after these guys. But there wasn't a sense yet that they were anything near a front runner. And I remember Rich saying, we were just talking about the Nets and they had beaten the Warriors. It was a really good win for them. And he said, you know, they're kind of like, I remember him saying something like they're like the mid-major college team that's breaking through, you know, like just how you said that, spunky. And that's what they felt like. They had like a lot of overachieving guys. Joe Harris was emerging then. Spencer Dinwiddie was emerging. D'Angelo Russell had come from the Lakers and was, you know, really starting to get his footing as a very good player in the league. And I even think of that conversation with Rich, and that was only, you know, 7 months, 6 months before they, you know, they decided to sign with Brooklyn. It is an incredible transformation. It is Brooklyn's the one place I really wish, listen, I wish there were fans everywhere. But the Nets have always been that, just the other team, just like the Clippers have been in LA with the Lakers. But as great as the Knicks have been, and that's another, I mean, what Tom Thibodeau has done and what they've done with the Knicks and how competitive they are is another thing. And it's always going to be it's still always going to be a Knicks town, even with these three guys here. Although I would like to see what it would be like in that arena, what the fan base would be like. Would it be, I mean, so many times you'd go to Nets games and they were still there to see, you know, Kobe was coming in, there was the Lakers, and that was true in a lot of cities. But I really wanted to see, is there this big Nets base that was going to be not just people wandering over there curious or getting tickets or, hey, I want to go see what it looks like. But like we're Nets,
it's literally like on my walk home from the subway. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. Barclays Center is right there. I have friends that live, like you could get off the subway. Hey, you know what? Who's in town tonight? Let me go see a game. I don't know what, you know, a carry is. I don't know what a double dribble is, but I'm going to go see. Let me go see a game. I mean, I think there was some of that too.
Yeah, no, it's they're going to be, we're going to be talking about them.
Can I give the Knicks some love, by the way, because you just mentioned them?
Yes.
So when they, in the first week of the season, my first 10 things, I wrote about Julius Randle and the Knicks. I love Julius Randle. And I wrote something like, maybe the results aren't going to be all that much different, but it's a you know it when you see it thing. And you watch them play even in the first week of the season, and they were coherent. They had an identity. They played hard. They were organized. And yeah, the talent was the talent, and it was probably not going to be a great season, but you knew it when you saw it. Something's a little bit different here. And then they went from 5-3 to 5-8. They lost 5 in a row, and their offense was awful. 89 points. I'm looking at it now. It's just awful offense. And you had a sense of, okay, this is the real Knicks. Reality has set in. Then they win three straight. Over Boston, yeah, no Tatum, but Kemba played. They beat him by 30. Over Orlando, okay, Orlando's got a million injuries. Still beat him. And then last night in Golden State, Draymond gets ejected, but they were ahead when Draymond got ejected, and they end up winning by 15. Great moments by Quickly and Toppin late in the game. Another very nice RJ Barrett game. Now, again, it's early still, but for them to right the ship and win three straight games pretty emphatically, when previous Knicks teams we've seen, not only would it have gone down the drain, they would have had an emergency press conference with morose executives. They would have fired the coach. All the back pages would have been laughing at them. They just calmly went out and won three straight games. It's a little thing. I'm just saying, let's take note of it. The Knicks righted the ship and are now 500, and we're 16 games into a 72 games max season. Like, it's a significant portion. They look like they're going to be in the play-in race all year.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, like, Tom Thibodeau was the perfect coach for Mitchell Robinson. Perfect coach to come in. You know, for the entire group, he's just brought structure, organization, a way of playing. Like, there's a way of playing that here's what we need to do to be successful. And you've seen them buy into the blueprint. Ian O'Connor said late last night on Twitter, he said, you think back to the 90s when you could stay up late and it was to stay up late and watch a Knicks road trip out west. And if you're a Knicks fan, when's the last time you might give the Knicks a shot at 7:30 at night when they're playing, and then by 10 of 8, you're off to something else. But you're going to stay up late and watch them play in Golden State and watch them play Portland and watch them play the LA teams. If you're a Knicks fan, you can do that again.
Yeah.
Usually that's where you go to lose 6-7. That's where your season would go to die, right?
Yeah, the West Coast game's a big commitment for a fan. You know, you're going to be up till 12:30, 1 in the morning. I do think it's fitting that we started this segment talking about the Nets and we finished it talking about the Knicks. I think we should just let that be.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Speaking of games last night, Utah, New Orleans, and Utah's playing great. I think seven in a row for them. They're Mike Conley is – this is the Mike Conley that Justin Zanuck and Dennis Lindsay traded for. You see his role, their bench. You wrote about it in your 10 things today, just how good that second unit has been. But on the other side of it, I'm going to start there. New Orleans, you wrote a great piece on Brandon Ingram this week. And that's been the team I thought that Stan Van Gundy would have initially. The impact that Tibbs is having in New York, I thought Stan was going to have that initially in New Orleans. Now, they've been on a long road trip. They've been away for 12, 13 days. But let's start with Brandon Ingram. What pulled you toward that piece with him? Because he's a marvelous guy, but quiet. You did a piece talking to a lot of guys who coached him, Joe Boylan, Brian Keefe, former assistants, some current guys, and sort of shaped it as an important player for this era for a couple of reasons.
Well, that's why initially that piece was going to be much different. You know, before the bubble, I did a podcast series where I caught up. Let's catch up with every one of the teams that's coming back to the bubble because it had been 4 months. And for the Pelicans one, I really dove in and watched a lot of film because I was fascinated with the Pelicans. And it's ironically, Stan was my guest for that episode. And 4 months later, he was the coach. And I just became really interested in Ingram. And I was interested in him also in the most improved awards race, thinking about whether he should win it or not. Because there was no denying his numbers. I mean, for the shooting leap he made last year and the scoring leap he made from 18 to 25, shooting 39% from three, 80-something at the line, that's huge. You don't see a lot of guys make that, particularly when their responsibility on offense increases and they have to take more shots. And the more I watched him, the more I thought, really great that he made this leap. I don't think his impact on winning games matches his numbers. I think he's a good playmaker who could be a really good one. And I thought his defense really slipped last year, and he's admitted it. And I said on my pod, I said, I'm almost more interested in the Brandon Ingram that averages 22-8-8 and plays really good defense than I am in the guy that averages 26-5-5 and plays bad defense. And going from player A to player B, I just became fascinated with that process. Like, because defense and playmaking, particularly defense, are two things when people watch the game, it's harder to see how have you gotten better. What passes are you making that you weren't making before? What's the timing on those passes? How has that changed? I thought that process was really fascinating. So the piece initially was just going to be, this guy is the most important player in the NBA, just in terms of if he hits and Zion hits, they've really got something there. And if they plateau, they have something, but it's not something. And then I interviewed him for like an hour on Zoom, and I wanted to do it face-to-face. I wanted to see him. I wanted to have a real conversation because I wanted to show him clips of plays. And I was just blown away by how funny he was, by how self-effacing he was, by how willing he was to get into the weeds of his game, his good points, his flaws, to tell stories about Magic Johnson, about Stan, about his past. And I had heard great intel on Brandon. I never really interviewed him at length, but I had heard people say, you're going to like him. He's a hard worker. He just cares about basketball. And he was just an open book. He was willing to discuss things that were not just going to pump him up. And I just became blown away by him. And I just thought, well, let me just turn this into a Brandon Ingram thing. Let me just go to town and start interviewing coaches and his family and former teammates. And it sort of just went from there. I tried to keep the peg of the spine of, this guy can swing the NBA balance of power if he develops in ways X, Y, and Z. But I blew it up into something broader that hurt my brain for a couple of weeks trying to craft it. But I came away, you know, there are just certain guys that you click with and that you can talk ball with, and they have fun personalities. And I just really enjoyed getting to know him.
I love the passage in there about after signing his max deal, reaching out to Brian Keefe, who had been an assistant with the Lakers, and put a lot of time in with him in the gym, and said, hey, thanks for your role in that. And that, like, you know, that's like the, you know, the student that goes back to the teacher years later and, you know, makes it feel like, hey, thanks for helping me become this or achieve that. And there's a lot of those guys in the league who put in a lot of hours with players, and ultimately the player gets the credit. I mean, it's the player who deserves the credit, but I thought that was pretty neat to see him go back to Brian and, you know, kind of circle back with him and some others. The Jazz, Zach, I mean, mentioned them at the start of this, and Donovan Mitchell has been fantastic. A weird moment with Shaq.
That was really night. I didn't see that because I was watching Knicks Warriors and then I went to bed. I didn't see that. And I woke up this morning. I was like, is Shaq trying to inject himself into Donovan Mitchell's career arc? Like, does he want to say, like, I've motivated him to take the next step by being so direct? I didn't understand what was happening.
Looking back, it was very uncomfortable.
I love the way Donovan handled it.
He handled it beautifully. I think what Shaq's trying to do is, I'm gonna motivate him. I'm going to be a motivational tool for him in that moment. Is that how we would do it? Probably not. I don't know if Donovan knew what to make of it, but he handled it well. I don't think Shaq was trying to insult him.
No, I don't either. I think he was.
Yeah. But it was still.
But Donovan doesn't need outside motivation.
No.
That dude is rock solid. You know, he. Mm-hmm. I went to a charity event he did in Connecticut a couple of months ago, and I talked to him a little bit afterwards, and we talked about the playoff series and Mike Conley's shot, and he hunched over when you could tell he was still recovering from the blow of losing that series. And he's proud of how he played in that series, the duel with Jamal Murray and all that. But you could tell X months later, he was still aching you know, to get out of the to get further in the playoffs than they have.
Yeah, they're going to be, you know, they've, and you wrote about it too, Jordan Clarkson's impact on that team. That trade from Cleveland early last season, a couple second-round picks, as I recall.
Exum.
Dante Exum, who unfortunately has just never, he was a throw-in ultimately in the to the Rockets in the Harden, the bigger Harden deal this year, and got injured again. But yeah, Clarkson has been an immense player. Then they re-signed him this summer, and that's a team in Utah that is, you know, they always talk about like, can we put a sustainable team together? That's a team now locked in under contract, and a coach, you know, Quinn Snyder, who, if you did a draft of NBA, if you made all 30 NBA, if you opened up all 30 jobs, and you had a draft of coaches, he goes what in your top five?
Yeah, he's top five for sure.
Top five for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, you start. Yeah, I think he would go top five. I voted him coach of the year once. I think 3 seasons ago or 2 seasons ago. He's a great coach. Yeah, they're playing well. I mean, I still think they're below the Lakers and the Clippers in championship equity, but they are proving they've separated themselves from everyone else in the West early. And at the very least, like, it's not going to be any fun to play them when they're clicking in the playoffs.
One last thing, and speaking of coaching, Zach, this is a time of the year where you see it in the NFL, and the coaching carousel in the NFL is different than the NBA. I think part of it is, well, I think there's probably more focus on the coach in the NFL. There might be than the NBA in some cases, but the hires all happen. The firings all happen in the first day or two. They have essentially what they call Black Monday, and a bunch of guys are fired, and then the interview, like, because they're competing, I think, for staff, they're competing for coordinators and who's going to hire who, you see these hires move quicker. And I think sometimes it creates more focus on who all the candidates are. And you see it in the NFL with Black coaches and, you know, Eric Bieniemy. I think there's one job open left, I think Houston. And is he going to get one of these jobs? He's been the premier coordinator on the premier team in the league in Kansas City. And rightfully so, it's a significant story. And, you know, the NBA generally has had a better hiring record than the NFL has. But we don't talk as much about the assistants in the NFL, in the NBA, as we do in the NFL. And I think there's a group of young and, you know, not so young Black assistants who are going to be head coaches. And I thought last year's interview process, guys didn't get jobs, but I think, Zach, there are a few guys on the cusp. And I would tell you, Darvin Ham in Milwaukee, who made an incredible impression with the Clippers, with Indiana, Jamal Mosley in Dallas, made a great impression. Again, in L.A., they interviewed a bunch of guys, interviewed in other places. Wes Unseld Jr. with the Nuggets, who Mike Malone, to his credit, Mike gave, I think, Wes a lot of praise for that Nuggets defense in the bubble and the role he played. And there are others, and I know there's – but I think we are going to see in the NBA – you're going to see some of these candidates start to break through and get jobs. And we just don't talk about it the way we do the NFL. But I think there's just, and there's others. I don't want to do just a list here, but certainly I think those guys are among the most prominent right now who are, I think, really close.
Yeah, and Jaren Collins' name has come up before. Yep. Charles Lee's another Milwaukee assistant, David Vanderpool, and Jordy Fernandez with the Nuggets. And I think, you know, Chauncey's a rookie coach.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In the Clippers. But I know Chauncey. And Chauncey's going to do big, big things in the NBA if he sticks it out. So there are, and again, I don't want to make it a list because then it's about who you left off. So those are just names that are off the top of my head. Melvin Hunt's another one. Yeah. But there are certainly, you know, there are a lot of great candidates. And yeah, I haven't really followed the Bieniemy story in the NFL. I don't really know what's going on. I saw that it became a thing. But, you know, certainly there's just a ton of guys. And I do think it's important to keep beating the drum on that because the coaching and executive ranks are not representative of what the game looks like.
No, it's not. And you mentioned Chauncey, and you're right. Like, he's come, you know, he kind of came close on the front office side of it. He did interview in Indiana for coaching. But I think the feeling had always been if Chauncey just takes an assistant job for a year or two, it will not be long before he just needed to be on the bench and be around it. And being, and that's a great staff in LA. Ty Lue, who's outstanding, and having Kenny Atkinson on that staff. Roy Rogers, who's a very good NBA.
Dan Craig is there too from Miami. Yeah, like, yeah. They're, that staff is loaded.
Yeah, yeah. They spent money for that staff, and they went out and got top guys. So I think that's going to be, for Chauncey, you know, that will be impactful for him. But I wanted to hit on that. We don't talk about it enough. And it's important in this league. And I think, you know, I think for the NBA, and I think, listen, you look at the job too, JB Bickerstaff has done in Cleveland. I think with this group, even back to when he took over for John Beilein, I want to say they're playing around 500 basketball. From then it was a short window from there to the end of the season. And then, you know, a great win over the Nets the other night, but they've been, you know, without Kevin Love really at all this season, you know, they've been more than competitive. But Zach, good catching up as always. Maybe there's a Woj low in our future somewhere.
Maybe
ESPN
that'd be
on TV. Have you heard about that? I haven't heard about it. But
no, it'd be fun.
It would be fun. Have a great weekend. We will talk soon, Zach.
My pleasure. Good to see you, and stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Woj Pod. A big thank you to our guest today, ESPN's Zach Lowe. Be sure to listen to new and archived episodes of the Woj Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, the Low Post with Zach Lowe, the Hoop Collective, hosted by Brian Windhorst and Jalen and Jacoby. Be sure to check out their podcasts wherever you get your pods. We'll catch you next time. Be well.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.